As an invitation to the beloved Imam of our time and an invitation to the Shuhada, please recite aloud a salawat. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين سيدنا مولانا أبي القاسم محمد وعلى أهل بيت الطيبين الطاهرين. For the hastening of the reappearance of our beloved Imam, please recite aloud salawat. So that we may be among his true companions, his true lovers, his true followers, please recite a louder salawat. First and foremost, as always, we'd like to thank Allah for giving us the opportunity to get together again on these nights. We pray by the blessing and the right of Amir al-Mu'mineen, who we've come here to commemorate, that there is more barakah given to these sessions, and the hajat that everyone have on these nights are also fulfilled. For the fulfillment of those hajat, especially the hajat of the proximity towards the beloved Imam of our time, please recite one loud salawat. We find ourselves in very interesting times. We highlighted this at the beginning yesterday as well, that when we look at the culture that we are in at the moment, the state of the culture that we're in at the moment, when we look at the state of the media, when we look at the state of education at the moment, all of these things which are pretty much bringing up to an extent us, and also more so the next generation after us, you slightly begin to worry at what's happening. On one side, you have these institutions that are taking care of the tarbiyah of our children to an extent. On the other side, we have so many chains which tie us down to, for example, our job or our studies, and we just don't have that freedom to be able to actually help, for example, our next generation, or even more so, like, even help ourselves. And, you know, on one side, you have us in this situation where you have the state of culture, media, and education like that, and us being tied down, not being able to do a lot of work. On the other side, you have industries which are propped up by billions of pounds to end up with one movie, for example, as their product. Right? They have billion dollar industry set up to give you the end result of one TV show, for example, or for example one video game, and on the other side it's us with all those limitations, with all those problems. Before anyone, by the way, you know, takes this down the road of it sounds like a conspiracy theory, right, there's just one small question I would ask the people who, you know, when in that strategy room, the powers that be, whoever they are, when they decided to design those games the way that they did, when they decided to make those movies the way that they did, when they decided to work on those TV shows with those certain messages the way that they did, at the very least, did they sit down and think, how can we benefit Islam? What can we do right now that will help further and strengthen the frontiers of the Islamic Ummah? Is that what they would have thought about? At the very least, forget the conspiracies. Fine, if you can't prove the links that exist between certain think tanks, certain policymakers, and those institutions, at the very least, you can ask this question. Did they have Islam as an interest in their heart when they went about doing these things? So this is the situation that we find ourselves in. When you are in such a situation, forget pursuing the divine objectives. You have to do so much. You have to work so hard just to survive, right? Just to have your faith secure, So much effort has to be put in for you to be able to achieve just that. But that's not why we were here. We were not here just to survive. We were not here just so our iman could be safe. We were here so we could take flight, right? We were here so that we can reach perfection of man. We were supposed to be flowing against the current that we find ourselves in, not just standing still in the water. But the situation is so difficult that we see around us, with so many limitations that we have from our side as well, that we end up just standing still. The best of us are able to resist that current and they're able to stand still. So we need all the help that we can get. Now, there are a couple of ways we can take these programs. One way is we allow you guys to enter and we put you in this bubble, which is completely detached from the outside world. It's completely detached from the issues and problems that you are faced with outside. And then after the program is over, after the du'as are finished, you leave. And you go back to that world with, you know, lots of problems. It's like you kind of slept for 3-4 hours, right? You became numb to everything that existed around you. Did the time that you spent over here actually help you? Did it benefit you in any way in regards to those real issues that you're facing with outside or not? Right? This is the theme which we picked up on yesterday. We said that the relationship we have with the holy month of Ramadan needs to be such that we don't just use it as a month to stockpile thawab for the afterlife, but we also try and understand what we can benefit from this holy month that will help us in this life as well. Right? Remember, the byproduct was the reward that you get afterwards. But the holy month, primarily, and we said this about the Holy Quran as well, primarily it was there as a guide for us now. And the byproduct was the reward that you get in the afterlife. So that's what we said. We said if we're going to have a discussion over here, we're not going to detach you from the rest of the world. We're not going to make you come into a little bubble and then, you know, release you, like pop that bubble once the program is over. It's like, no, you come here and let's try and understand from this holy month, what are those things that we can gain from that will help us when we step outside these doors. On that note, we mentioned one point and it was very much, you know, mentioned in the passing, and I realized that's actually quite a big mistake. The first point that we mentioned that we can gain from the holy month of Ramadan is this month teaches us sabr, right? And what I mentioned in passing was this word sabr, right? We should not translate it as patience. It's the wrong translation. Rather, it should be translated as steadfastness, right? To remain steadfast. That's what sabr means. And I kind of brushed that aside and we, you know, continued with our conversation. I thought that was of slight disservice to what this concept actually means, especially taking into consideration how it is misunderstood and misused in the time that we live in. Remember, this is a concept, this patience is a concept that can very easily be used to pacify you as opposed to it becoming a guideline for you to be active in the world that's around you. Just to give you an example of this specific point, which is a bit more clearer, is the concept of tawakkul, right? When we talk about tawakkul, this reliance upon Allah, One of the main arguments that the communists used before the Islamic Revolution of Iran against the Islamic movement that was trying to bring about change is this idea, this concept of tawakkul within our faith. They would say, how do you think your religion can actually bring about change when you have things such as tawakkul? Why? Because, okay, what is tawakkul? Whenever we go to your people, the ones who are in the mosque and stuff, and we say that, look, we have these problems, we need to sort these out, they say, we have Allah, He will sort it out for us. Tawakkul. That's how they were defining tawakkul, this reliance upon Allah. Tawakkul became a pacifier. Or as the communists like to say, It became an opiate for the masses. It was putting people to sleep. When in reality, not only is tawakkul not a pacifier, it's one of the strongest sources of motivations that Muslims have. Why? What does tawakkul mean? This isn't my topic, so I'm not going to go into it in detail, but just in the passing, what does tawakkul mean? Right? Tawakkul is the belief that you carry out your responsibility and leave the rest, leave the result in the hands of Allah. What does that mean? How is that a motivation and not a pacifier? What that means is, regardless of how dangerous the situation is, regardless of whether you can see a door out of the problem in front of you or not, regardless of how it seems like you're completely trapped, what tawakkul teaches you is, even in that difficult situation, you keep your head down and you keep working hard. Why? Because there is an Allah and He can open a door for you where you think no door even existed. Right? Tawakkul was supposed to be a source of motivation like that. And because of understanding it incorrectly, or should I say, because it was practiced incorrectly by Muslims, the communists used a concept like tawakkul to say that, in fact, this is something that pacifies you. Same thing with sabr. It's like, again, like you go to your boys and you say, look, we're facing these problems, so many trials, so many hardships, what do we do? And the response we get is, have sabr, right? Be patient. It's all good, right? It's like, how is your religion supposed to bring about change? What relevance? Remember, we spoke about this yesterday in the last session. What relevance does a religion have in which tawakkul is defined in such a way that it pacifies you and sabr is defined in such a way that it pacifies you as well? What use is it to you right now? Right? In fact, when Ayatollah Khamenei is discussing these concepts, he actually addresses the communists and says, we are with you in condemning that religion, even if it is Islam that defines these terms in such a way. Because this is not Islam. This is not what the Holy Quran defines these concepts as. This is not what the Holy Prophet defined what religion was supposed to be. So when it comes to the concept of sabr, one of the reasons why I thought it was a disservice to just kind of mention it in the passing yesterday and move on is because I came across this verse which kind of shook me. If you look at Surah Ali Imran, verse number 120, it says, if some good should befall you, it upsets them. But if some ill befalls you, they rejoice at it. Yet, if you are patient and God-weary, if you have sabr and you have taqwa, their guile, their mischief, their scheming will not harm you in any way. Indeed, Allah encompasses what they do. Okay, so I came across this verse and I was like, hang on a second. We started off by explaining how we're in such difficult times, how we're surrounded by all this darkness and we're like in the middle of it and going deeper and deeper every day we live, right? This horrible scenario. What is this verse saying? This verse is saying that if you have sabr, which has been wrongly translated as patient over here, if you have sabr and if you have taqwa, what will happen? A promise of God. If you have these two things, then the schemes of those who wish to harm you, right, will have no effect on you. It's like, oh snap. It's a promise of God. Maybe we should pause our discussion and actually open up what sabr is supposed to mean in reality, so that hopefully through understanding the correct definition of it, we can see how it would practically apply within our lives as well. Because it's the application of these correct definitions which grants us the promises of God, not just knowing the definition. So hopefully we can take the discussion in that direction. Please recite the salawat. So as I said, sabr, a lot of the time it's wrongly translated as patience, right? And even more wrongly, it may be translated as patience, but even more wrongly, it's understood as acceptance, right? What is patience? What is sabr? In this wrong understanding, basically anyone can do whatever they want to you. How much will do you have within you to not retaliate? How long can you not respond for? The longer you can withstand that, the longer you can accept this kind of treatment, the more patience you have. In the wrong understanding of what sabr is supposed to be. Is that what sabr is supposed to be though? Important question. You see how that pacifies you. Is that what sabr is supposed to be? There's a discussion, there's actually a book out in English. I haven't seen it for a very long time. It was actually one of the first books out in English that I saw from Ayatollah Khamenei. And it's, I think the title is The Discourse to Patience. It's an amazing discussion. He introduces this topic in a way that I've not seen before. Even here, like when I was reading a passage, and the first time he mentions sabr, the way he presented it was like this. And again, like, maybe this isn't a dictionary definition of what sabr is, but boy, does it bring you close to understanding what it's supposed to mean. He says, sabr means to stay on the battlefield for as long as possible, no matter how difficult it gets. I don't need a dictionary definition after that. I've understood it. Okay, it's no longer patience. It's no longer acceptance. It becomes steadfastness. It becomes resistance. Resistance against whatever may be thrown against you. That's what patience is. To always keep the objective as your primary focus, no matter how difficult it gets. That's what sabr is. Just to back this up from the Quran, again, this is a discussion that he has. If you look at Surah A'raf, verse number 127 and 128, there is a discussion that takes place between the advisors of Fir'aun and Fir'aun regarding what we should do with Hazrat Musa. And this is after the miracle of the staff, right? This is after Hazrat Musa has come to the palace of Fir'aun, and the magicians of Fir'aun have changed their faith, right? And things seem to be going in the favor of Hazrat Musa. The elite, so I'm quoting from the Quran now, or the translation of the Quran, I should say. The elite of Pharaoh's people said, "Will you leave Moses and his people to cause corruption in the land and to abandon you and your goals?" He said, as in Pharaoh responded, "We will kill their sons and spare their women, and indeed we are dominant over them." What was the response of Hazrat Musa? As in, what did Hazrat Musa say to his people? He said, "Turn to Allah for help and be patient. Have sabr." Question. This is Fir'aun speaking, right? We know what he's capable of. He's saying that we're going to, you know, kill their children. By the way, when it says spare their women, that doesn't mean we're going to kill their children and we're just going to leave their women. No, it means we're not going to kill them, because then we're going to use them for our slave or our work and so on and so forth, right? Do you really think, in response to a threat like that from Fir'aun, what Hazrat Musa is saying is turn to Allah for help and relax? You don't need to do anything. Is that what he's saying? Is he saying turn to Allah for help and let's see how much of this killing we can take? Let's see how many of our women we will allow to be taken as slaves. Is that what it means? Right? If sabr meant acceptance, then that's how you would understand this verse. But no, we definitely understand from this that sabr does not mean acceptance. What Hazrat Musa was saying was a call to arms. He was telling his people to get ready to resist, stand up and fight. That's what he was saying. Do you see how one meaning of the same word is completely putting everyone to sleep, and the other meaning is the exact opposite? How have we understood, not just sabr, but generally things in our religion, how have we understood it? It's very important to make sure that these concepts, we are defining them correctly, because you can see how much of an effect this definition would have on your practical life. What rules, duties, and obligations are forced upon you once you realize, oh snap, this is what sabr is supposed to mean. Please recite a salawat. In fact, if you see the continuation of this verse, so he says, Moses said to his people, turn to Allah for help and have sabr. The earth indeed belongs to Allah, and he gives its inheritance to whomever he wishes of his servants, and the outcome will be in favor of those who have taqwa. Right? We already spoke about what taqwa means. Again, in our last session, we stressed, we proved beyond doubt that whenever taqwa is mentioned, whenever the muttaqeen is mentioned, it's a reference to those people who fulfill divine objectives and their duties and responsibilities in this world, and they reap the reward for it in the afterlife. It's very much a reference for those people who are alive, well, and active right now, not those who are disconnected from their communities. So what is being said over here? Not only is he telling them to have sabr, he is promising them victory. Which prophet, right? How could you even maintain respect for a religion in which a prophet would be telling his people to do absolutely nothing against an onslaught and victory will be promised as well? Do nothing, sit on your hands, and everything will be given to you on a plate. It goes against what we understand to be the wisdom of God. What's the point of even sending us in this world then? If it's not for our growth, if it's not for us reaching perfection. So if everything's being handed to us on a plate, then where's the wisdom of God gone in giving us victory without work? What we understand from sabr, furthermore, therefore, is that it's meant to be more than just acceptance. Please recite a salawat. So, taking the discussion further on, Atullah Khamnai explains a tradition of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please recite salawat. In which he splits sabr into three types. One is patience upon obedience. The second is patience. Sorry, let me rephrase that. The first is being steadfast upon obedience. The second is being steadfast in the face of sins. And the third is being steadfast in the face of tribulations. Right? Steadfast upon obedience. What does that mean? You do not get tired of carrying out a command of Allah regardless of how difficult it gets. You like fasting? Do it in London, okay? For the length that you have to. And you will remain steadfast upon it regardless of how difficult it gets. Before the holy month, you may have struggled to spend even a few hours without water, a few hours without food, right? But the strength that you can gain from this holy month is that after the holy month is over, you're able to, if you can remain upon the command of Allah in the holy month, then that will train you up to remain upon the commands of Allah outside of the holy month. I'm going to move on to the next point. Remaining steadfast in the face of sins. Again, it's about making sure that you're not letting the temptation of sins affect you. The holy month is asking you to control yourself upon those things which are halal for the rest of the months. The question is this, or the point that we want to take from this, is this, that if someone is careful about the halal during the holy months, how much more difficult will it be for them to be negligent towards the haram outside of the holy months? Again, see how the holy month is training you. The third point, steadfastness in the face of hardships. There are two types of hardships. In the first type of hardship, you don't have a choice, right? So, for example, it's a natural disaster or it's an illness and you don't have a choice. What is your response to that? Do you throw everything aside? You give up whatever you were doing? And that's it? That's the end of the story? What is your response? Remaining steadfast in the face of hardships. Those hardships which you don't have a choice, right? Is what, again, the holy month of Ramadan can help you with. Why? Because you are being forced to go into a situation which other people who do feel hardships, who do go through, for example, natural disasters or illness, have to face. They can't eat whatever they want. They can't drink whatever they want. The other luxuries as well, right? The other type of hardship that you would face is hardships which you accept yourself. Like, you have a choice whether to accept it or not. You choose to go on a journey with full knowledge that if I go on this journey and this is the objective I want to get to, then there will be trials and tribulations, right? If you look at the journey of all of those people who decided to go with the Prophet, our final messenger, for example, you look at how Bilal was dealt with, for example. We've all heard of the stories of how he was tortured, right? The hardships that he faced. What was his response to those hardships? Did he give up the message? Did he waver? If anything, he became stronger in his faith towards the Prophet and the divine mission, right? I mean, they were put in a situation where there was a point, the sanctions that were put upon the Prophet and his companions were to the extent that they were sharing one date between people. And when that date, the flesh of the date would be finished, they would share the seed of that date. That's how difficult the situation got for them. But they continued. If you look at those who were the companions of the Ahlul Bayt, for example, we have so many stories, right? There's a very famous one in which a person came to, if I'm not mistaken, it was Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam. Please recite salawat. And he said to the Imam, "Oh Imam, I love you." Right? And the response that you would normally expect from that is, "Thank you, I love you too." Or at least a thank you. The response he got from the Imam was, "Are you sure?" And he was surprised, like, "Yes, I'm sure, like, I love you." And he's like, "Okay, then from today onwards, get ready to face trials and tribulations." The story of Maysam al-Tammar, you guys all know it. He refused to stop praising Amir al-Mu'mineen and he became shaheed as a result. And all the lovers of the Ahlul Bayt throughout the times, even till today, for the love that they have of the Ahlul Bayt, how many trials and tribulations they have to go through as well. These are all trials and tribulations which they chose for themselves. They chose to go on that journey. Inshallah, each and every one of us who are sitting here will be among those who have chosen to go on this journey. And we want to go on this journey, not because we think it's safe. We want to go on this journey with the full knowledge that there's problems on this path. With the full knowledge that even in a place like London, there's a chance that you'll be walking outside. And if someone finds out that you're a follower of the Ahlul Bayt, then you could be in trouble. We accept all of that because the objective is valuable for us. Remaining steadfast, having sabr, is not wavering and always keeping the objective in mind. There's a few stories I wanted to mention. I'm going to mention this person. I have to. I can't finish my second talk without mentioning a story from one of the shuhada. There's a shaheed by the name of Shaheed Tayyib. Shaheed Tayyib was a very interesting character. He was the head gangster of the underworld in Iran before the revolution came about. This person would do everything you can imagine a gangster doing. And he was as negligent towards, like, you know, salah and fasting and stuff as, you know, anyone who, you know, doesn't have anything to do with kind of religious side would be. However, there's one thing which he never compromised on. The only person who was allowed to organize and bring about processions on the day of Ashura onto the streets of Tehran was Tayyib. No one else had the permission to do so. The Shah of the time thought he had Tayyib in his pocket. He always used to express a lot of love for Lady Zahra Salamu Alayha and for Imam Hussein and his son. That's one thing he never compromised on. What happened? When the heat started to rise for the Shah, one thing he wanted to make sure of was that the underworld isn't going to turn against me. In the eyes of the Shah, the underworld was like an army for him that he could use against these, like, you know, mullahs. Like, why are they going to have any relationship or any respect for these guys? The Shah sent a message to Shahid Tayyib saying that we want you to detach yourself from this movement of Khomeini, right? We want a written statement from you which expresses that you have nothing to do with him and you don't like him and so on and so forth. He refused to do so. The Shah was stunned. They brought him in. They're like, why? They're like, you know, if you don't accept this, what we're going to do to you, we're going to torture you and this and that. He's like, I don't care. I'm not going to say anything against this man. And again, he asked, like, what do you have to do with these religious class, right? You're like a gangster and da-da-da. He's like, no. I will never take a step or say a word against the son of Lady Zahra Salamu Alayha. This... this person is a Sayyid. He is the son of Lady Fatima, Salamu Alayha. There is no way that you can get me to take a step against him. Those times for Shahid Tayyib were amazing. Do you know who he was sharing his prison cell with? The likes of Shahid Beheshti. The likes of Agha Khamenei and the other revolutionaries. He learned his religion from the small times that they would have together in prison. He changed his life. In the end, till the end of his life, he refused to change his position. And they killed him through the tortures. But he refused to change his position. His brother came to Imam Khomeini after his death. After they found out that he'd become Shaheed. His brother came to Imam Khomeini and presented him with the wasiya. And he said, I have a message for you from my brother. He said, tell Imam Khomeini that we hope for his shafa'ah on the day of judgment. The response Imam Khomeini, the person who does not just throw around words for fun, his response was, don't worry, the likes of your brother will give us shafa'a on the day of judgment. A message was sent out by Imam Khomeini to the students of the Hawza to make up all the qadha, fast and prayers of this person. The qadha, fast and prayers of this person were done by the students of the Hawza around the Haram of Bibi Ma'asuma, salallahu alayha. Look at what he became. Remaining steadfast. And as Hazrat Musa came, you remain steadfast. What happens? You ask for the help of Allah, you will be victorious. It's because of people like that, because they remain steadfast, that we are here right now. This is a sign of the victory. And it's just the beginning. Please recite salawat. I'll finish off with this. And the reason I want to finish off with this is because it gives me a very good point to start off with in the final lecture. We're talking about remaining steadfast. And we're saying how the holy month of Ramadan, it helps us to stay steadfast, right? Why do we slip up? Why do we sometimes, you know, not remain steadfast? The Imam addresses his companions. He says, do not wish for the impossible. They said to him, who is it that wishes for the impossible? The Imam replied, you do. Do you not wish for comfort in this world? They replied, yes. So he said, comfort is impossible for the believer to secure in this world. One of the factors of why we lose that determination and will to remain steadfast is because of the pursuit of the comfort of this world. If you look at I'm going to finish on this. If you look at the sermons of Amir al-Mu'mineen, when he's addressing the people who had let him down, like this in itself is masayib. But take it into the consideration, take it from the viewpoint of going after this dunya, like going after the comforts. These are the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam with all of the fazail that he has towards his people. Oh my God, they are disgusted of me. Talking to his people. They are disgusted of me and I am disgusted of them. They are tired of me and I am tired of them. Change them for me with better ones and change me for them with worse ones. Oh my God, melt their hearts as salt melts in water. By Allah, I wish I had only 1,000 horsemen like the likes of which the enemy has. You are like broken arrows thrown over the enemy. By Allah, I am now in the position that I neither confirm your views nor hope for your support, nor challenge the enemy through you. What is the matter with you? What is your ailment? What is your cure? The other party is also men of your shape, but they are so different in character. Will there be talk without action, carelessness without piety, and greed in things not right? We need to decide what we're going to take from this holy month. If remaining steadfast is one of those things, then we can say to the Imam that, look, Imam, these are harsh words, but they're not for me. Inshallah, I'm not among these people. I'm among those people, as he says, mountains may move from their positions, but you should not move from yours. Grit your teeth, lend to Allah your heed. Plant your feet firmly on the ground. Have your eye on the remotest foe. Remember, remaining steadfast means keeping the eye on the objective at all times, regardless of how difficult it gets. And keep sure that success is only from Allah, the glorified. Please recite salawat.